This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Judy Collins.
Later on, we want bread, but we want roses too. The Lawrence, Massachusetts textile strike of 1912.
And now, women and immigrants from unity marches to preventing business as usual.
With Nelson Lichtenstein, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and director of the Center for Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy.
And we bid you a belated day without immigrants and a day without women, International Women's Day strike. Nelson.
Hello there. Glad to be with you.
Well, I can't think of anybody better to put in perspective the issue of the strike. Now, both the Day Without Immigrants and International Women's Day was also posited as a one-day strike. And I was elated to see us moving from the general protest rally, which was of enormous significance and importance, and they all have been since Trump took office. But can you put in perspective for us, historical perspective, and the significance of beginning to look at the issue of strikes as a manner of protest? And
yes,
thank you
for joining
us. The remarkable
thing today is that while the strike, as it was sort of codified, in the years since the 30s and into the today, traditional trade unions conduct, is really in abeyance very much. They don't take place very much, and they don't. They sometimes they win, but sometimes they don't. However, at the same time, all sorts of people who are not in unions and not in never done anything before of that sort are talking about a strike, even if they don't quite understand the meaning of it. And I've been to some meetings where that's the case, and I think that's terrific, because it indicates they want to do something which is more than just traditional party politics, or also more than the massive demonstrations, which are very good and which we've had, and they're more than that. What I have been arguing for some time now is that the tradition that was in the 19th century and really up to the middle of the 20th century was the word march or the word demonstration was practically synonymous with the word strike. That is, when you had from the antebellum era, the Lowell Mills to the Knights of Labor and on into the CIO and the Industrial Union period, when labor or other groups as well, immigrants as well, had a march down the street or a demonstration, it was on a weekday typically, and it closed down the workplaces. That tradition changed really in the 60s when the student movement and when we started having anti-war marches and later on other kinds of demonstrations on Saturdays. Now there was still good reasons for that. I mean, lots of people, you get out and all sorts of things, and they were all usually on Saturdays. The thing that I was inspired by was 11 years ago when the first Day Without Immigrants And there was a controversy about it. That is, this was 2006. There was an anti-immigration bill in Congress, and various sort of unions and Latino labor, Latino radio stations, sort of in California and elsewhere, said, "Let's have a day without immigrants." And there was a lot of controversy about it. Wait a minute! You're going to be hurting, people going without a day without work. You know, get money. What if they get penalized by their employer? And maybe we shouldn't do this. Anyway, it was a controversy. But it took place, I think it was a Wednesday, and it was a magnificent success. And what was remarkable was that that employers who would otherwise be extremely hostile to unions or other kinds of organizations just sort of shut down because they could see the power of this thing. And it was very successful. And I think that can be replicated. And it is being replicated today. I think there's potential for that. I see potential for that. I'll explain that in a bit if you'd like for me to do that.
Yeah, if you could expand on that and also how this relates to a general strike.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. I think the reason for doing this is not just to it's that to have what's happened with demonstrations on Saturdays, people coming together, it then dissipates afterwards. There's no kind of permanent organization. But if you're going to shut down workplaces, you need both organization beforehand and afterward. As I say, not necessarily a traditional union, but you need it. And so I think what's possible these days, and we've seen hints of it, for example, when the president of Uber, CEO, was sort of pressured to stay off of the Trump's board, and recently at a Walt Disney meeting, there was a lot of criticism of the president of Walt Disney to get out. This pressure did not come from some traditional union. It came from people, you know, working in maybe some were managers. And I think it's possible today that you could have what would be a kind of general strike. There really be sectorial strikes. That is, you know, you could have, and the issue is immigration, which affects the workplace, you know, and many places. So, for example, one day you could have, you know, Hollywood studios shut down. I mean, and, you know, there'd be sort of with a complicit agreement of some of the managers. Or another day, Silicon Valley are part of it. Or another day, some hospital or a university. And I think that that as ICE, you know, becomes more active and begins to pick up people who people know about, I think this is quite possible. So it's kind of it's not like the kind of general strike that Luxembourg, you know, talked about 100 years ago, where the whole country shuts down permanently. But there's sort of one day demonstration strikes in key industries, which indicate that the sort of the body politic is against what Trump is seeking to do.
Well, how does this relate to general strikes as they occur in Europe and also the general strikes that happened in the U.S. in the 30s and the 40s?
Yeah, well, okay, there is a difference here. The strikes that occurred in, like, the San Francisco general strike or Oakland, these were always, almost always, they were called by workers' unions when the state used the police or the National Guard to escort strike breakers either into the ports or into some building or sort of some factory. It was a protest against the state, but for use of the police. The strikes today, it's not specifically the police are going to, you know, are being used to escort strike breakers, but it is a kind of strike against the use of the police power as I would foresee it, you know, most likely event would be in terms of police power to round up undocumented immigrants. Or another example of this would be, going back to the 19th century, the Fugitive Slave Law. When the Fugitive Slave Law was put into effect in 1850, citizens of Boston and Concord and upstate New York, when the slave catchers came to pick up the slaves, they, you know, in the streets, and they prevented them, and they weren't, you could call them, they called them mobs or demonstrations, but people left work. And so really that, I think, is an historical analogy as well.
One of the exciting things that happened in this city occurred in 2006 on May Day in Union Square, where we saw immigrants taking the lead, 100,000 strong in Union Square, who stayed away from work. And very impressive, although not certainly in the numbers, but not insignificant, event occurred recently in New York where the Yemenis in particular, but other Muslim bodega shopkeepers, etc., closed, forced the stores to close. And indeed, even many of these store owners voluntarily closed them in acknowledgement of the power of these groups of workers who we don't necessarily think of in the traditional way that we thought of unions. And as a matter of fact, organized unions haven't been here.
Right. And I would extend that. Yes, that idea that I wrote some other pieces about this, that the American left was built by immigrants, and it will be built again by immigrants. I mean, you can go back to the Irish Fenians, the German anarchists, the Jewish Bundists, Italian anarchists, and of course the recently the Latinos for several decades. The core of the American left has been immigrants, and for many good reasons, because they feel marginal and because they feel threatened and because sometimes back in the homeland they were revolutionaries, and that's why they came here. And I think that's we can see it in front of our eyes today.
You know, one of the things that I was particularly entranced by in many ways in your article, which is how immigrants make the American left and Americans built him, right, and are going to do it again. And one of the things you pointed out is you look at Chicago and you kind of meld together what happened with the 1955 murder of Emmett Till. Yeah, and I wonder if you can, and before that you were speaking about the Puerto Rican nationalists. So take us to those places and give us a sense of the power that's there.
I consider African-Americans who left the South and went to the North, I consider them immigrants. And in fact, the Great Migration, which began in World War One, and and many of they went to Chicago and other great big cities in the North. And so they became political and they became really a part of the core of the civil rights movement. And so Emmett Till, the famous brutal murder of a young boy in Mississippi in 1955. I mean, this had been happening, all the time. This is nothing unusual about Emmett Till's murder. That had been going on. But when this happened, though, he was from Chicago. His family was connected to the packing house workers, to the NAACP. The Communist Party was a largely black organization still vital in Chicago. And all of these groups mobilized, and including the congressman, Hayes, who had come out of the packing house workers, and he actually went right down to Mississippi and sat in the courtroom, and that's why there was so much publicity, sitting there watching the trial. And so the Emmett Till became a national issue and became a kind of landmark moment for the civil rights movement because of the power now of these immigrants from the South to one and two and three generations who were organized in the North. And that's exactly what's happening today in California and New York and Chicago with Latinos and other immigrants. They're politically organizing themselves, and their weight is being felt, and it'll be felt even more.
Where do you see the role of labor and the evolution of these protests, especially since the Women's March? Do the women strike?
I mean, I think the labor is taking. I mean, some of the SEIU locals are taking part of the lead in the I think it will be a May Day set of demonstrations and strikes, and so on a weekday. I think the labor movement, I mean, which is today a plurality of all of those in the unions are either women or people of color or immigrants. It has to be involved in order to reestablish its legitimacy and for people to understand that the labor movement is a liberation movement. I mean, it began that way, and it has to be seen that way once again, because as simply a collective bargaining movement, it won't attract the power it needs. It's a movement of democracy and liberation, and that is essential. So, therefore, I'm critical of those unions that are seeking to form, to have some sort of deal with Trump, for a few jobs. This is very short-sighted, I think.
So two additional questions, Nelson, and that is, are we beginning to see the falling away of the organized labor, the AFL-CIO, who doesn't seem to have been present in any momentous form in this, and the real advent of workers' centers through immigrant workers and so on? That's one part of it, the significance. And for those people who don't really understand in any event, because they weren't enculturated with that, the issue of strikes. What does that mean to building a real resistance and a transformative power paradigm, which is certainly what we need, lest we fall right back into the hands of the Democratic Party liberals?
Yeah. No, I'll start with the second part of that question. First, I agree. That's interesting. I think there's a moment here. As I say, I'm struck. Just anecdotally, people want to have a strike. They don't even know what it is exactly, but they know that they want to do something. And that's why I think that the separation, the division between demonstrations like on a Saturday and strikes at work, that this has to be bridged, and it can be done by you know, if you're going to go out on a weekday, then you're going to have to think about work, and then you've got to talk to your fellow mates at work, and it's a kind of beginning of a kind of self-organization. So I think that we need to take advantage of that impulse to do something more dramatically than say the Democratic Party. I agree with you on that. On the question of labor itself, I mean, I think that one thing that Trump's done that's bad has been to reanimate this archaic view of labor as, like, you know, white male steel workers and coal miners. I mean, they aren't anywhere. That's not what labor is anymore. But he kind of reanimated that idea. And we, you know, the fact is, the labor movement in popular understanding has to be understood as the home health care workers and the nurses and the maids and janitors. This is what the labor movement is today. And I do think that wing of it, and much of it's in the SEIU, that SEIU has problems, but I think there is, they understand that. And many of their members are immigrants or no immigrants. So I think that can be part of this larger movement that's afoot here.
Well, we need to have you back to explore this even more conclusively. And I do strongly recommend the article, which was put out by Portside, which are really no more Saturday marches, but the particular one, How Immigrants Built the American Left and Can Build It Again. And we have been speaking with Nelson Lichtenstein, who teaches history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he directs the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. Promise to come back?
Yes, indeed.
Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead, go flying to us, singing their anxious call for bread. Small hearts and love and youth.
At the turn of the century, America was rapidly becoming an industrial society. Nearly 30 million immigrants had risked the long trip to the New World with dreams of a better life. Many found their way to the textile mills of New England, where the opportunity was work with low wages, long hours, and dangerous working conditions. The factory system ushered in new demands for efficiency and control.
I regard my people just as I regard my machinery.
Discrimination in the mills was widespread. Recruiting wagons, known as slavers, sought out young women and children who they could pay half as much as men. A family industry, they called it.
I used to go to school. And then a man came by to my house and asked my father why I didn't go to work. The man said, "You give me $4 and I will make papers come from the old country which say she is 14. I went to work and in about 2 weeks got hurt in my head. The machine pulled my scalp off. I was in the hospital 7 months.
One out of every 3 mill workers died before the age of 25. Unions gained popularity among workers seeking better working conditions. The American Federation of Labor had won an 8-hour day for thousands of craft workers. But unskilled textile workers remained unorganized. In 1911, the Massachusetts state legislature reduced the working week from 56 to 54 hours. Unwilling to let workers benefit, Lawrence's American Woolen Company, the world's largest textile plant, cut workers' wages. On January 12, 1912, when workers received their paychecks, cries of short pay rang throughout the mill. 14,000 workers poured into the streets.
Better start fighting than to start working!
In 2 weeks, 25,000 workers from 11 mills had joined the strike. The city of Lawrence sounded a riot call. The workers had shut down the largest mills in the world. Mill owners kept their machines running, although no cloth was being woven, in an attempt to deceive the strikers. Carrying banners that read bread and roses, the strikers expressed their demand for livable wages, bread, but also for dignity and respect, for roses in their lives. The Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, sent nationally known labor leaders to organize the strike. They formed strike committees, representing workers of 30 nationalities, held parades, and put up picket lines. Labeled anarchists, agitators, and fomenters of violence by the press, the strike leaders warned the unarmed workers not to resort to violence. Wobbly leader Bill Haywood.
They cannot weave cloth with bayonets. By all means, make this strike as peaceful as possible. All the blood spilled will be your blood.
Company guards sprayed workers in picket lines with freezing cold water from high-pressure hoses. The city of Lawrence called in the state militia. And on January 29th, police and troopers opened fire on a crowd of strikers, killing a young woman striker named Anna Lopeza. As resources diminished, the children of strikers were sent to stay with supporters in other cities. The children's pilgrimage drew national sympathy to the Lawrence strikers. The mill owners were outraged. On the morning of February 24th, 40 children gathered at the railroad station with their families. Without warning, club-wielding police attacked the parents and children. The nation reacted with horror.
Every right supposedly guaranteed under the Constitution has been ruthlessly taken from the industrial slaves of Lawrence.
I would rather never again wear a thread of woolen than know my garments had been woven at the cost of such misery as I have seen.
In response to national outrage, President Taft ordered an investigation. Many strikers, including a delegation of 16 children, testified before Congress about working conditions in the mills. With public support on their side, the strike committee made a final appeal. On March 12, 3 months after workers had walked off their jobs, the American Woolen Company, speaking for all Lawrence mills, surrendered. 2 days later, 25,000 men, women, and children strikers gathered on the Lawrence Common and voted on the settlement. The workers had won wage increases, overtime pay, and rules against discrimination.
You have demonstrated the common interest of the working class. In bringing all nationalities together, you have won the most single victory of any body of organized workers in the world.
Though the victory was an example to textile workers in all of New England, the dream of one big union was short-lived. It would be another quarter of a century before industrial workers would form a union strong enough to win lasting gains.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.